Frédéric Chopin was one of the great composers for piano. His work forever changed what we even imagine as possible on the piano, both technically and emotionally. Chopin was born March 1st, 1810, so we're celebrating his 200th birthday this year. Well, it's one thing to say he's great, but what makes him great? Our What Makes It Great commentator is joining me from the NPR studios in Washington, D.C., Robert Capello. Rob, welcome.
Thanks. Great to be here.
Chopin was such an amazing pianist, but the fact is Chopin never wrote an opera. He never wrote a symphony. Can we really call him a great composer, or was he just a great pianist?
Well, you know, I think one of the things that's so fantastic about Chopin is he literally redefines what we mean by great composer. Even though Chopin loved opera, loved symphonies, he absolutely knew who he was and who he wasn't. And he lived at the keyboard, and he created all his thoughts at the keyboard, but he had the courage to believe, you know, that the expression contained in a little three-minute mazurka could be as powerful as the expression in an entire four-hour Wagner opera. So he was a great composer redefining what a great composer could possibly be.
And who he was, I mean, a couple of things that were really at the core of Chopin's character and person. He was a pianist and he was Polish. And to help illustrate what made Chopin great, you've picked out one particular Polish dance, one of the mazurkas by Chopin. It's a mazurka in A minor, opus 17, number 4. And this piece has a very unusual beginning.
It does. And in fact, part of Chopin's revolution starts right from the first notes. And since the first 20 measures of this piece, in a way, are like a primer, they're designed for Rob Capello to talk in the studio about what makes it great on his 200th birthday. Let's hear those first 20 measures and then take them apart with an inch of its life, because everything that makes Chopin great is in these 20 measures.
The opening 20 measures of Chopin's Mazurka in A minor, sometimes called the Mazurka number 13, Chopin's Mazurka from his Opus 17 collection, that's number 4, by Artur Rubinstein. And Rob, at the very beginning of this Mazurka, it's almost like we're in this floating, ethereal world. You can't tell what the rhythm is. You almost can't even tell what the key is. What's going on at the beginning of this, Rob?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Unlike a classical period piece where you start in A minor, clear beginnings, clear endings. Here we start not on an A minor chord, but on a dissonant chord like this. Now, when you first hear this introduction, it sounds like it's just a self-contained dream fragment, and the piece actually begins when the mazurka tune begins. However, if you listen closely, there is a beautiful, subtle connection between the two sections. The introduction actually plays the same three notes over and over again. Do them again. Start them a third time, but decorate the end and go up. Those three notes that we repeat over and over again become the first three notes of the mazurka tune. And then the ending of the introduction become the next fragment of the mazurka tune. These two sections are related, but in a completely new poetic, romantic, subjective kind of way. So the mazurka tune seems to float as if in a trance out of this dream fragment of an introduction, a completely new kind of relationship between an introduction and the main body of a piece.
It's amazing to hear you talk about that, Rob, because when I hear that opening go by, it almost sounds like Bill Evans improvising this dreamy thing at the piano. But Rob, you're saying there's actually a lot of structure underlying that, what sounds like an improvisation.
This is art disguised as art. Though it sounds like Chopin was simply improvising this music in a salon, every element, rhythm, harmony, and melody is actually carefully controlled. We start off, as we've seen, with the notes of the introduction turned into the mazurka tune like this, with a beautiful dotted rhythm that gives us the feel, the impetus of a dance. Then this little note, as if it were improvised, just a quick grace note. Then even notes push us to a climax as we start to move beautifully towards a major key with this beautiful decoration. And then this moment is so exquisite. We have a little hesitation. We desperately want to resolve to major. But instead, we don't get it. We get instead this, that heart-rending chord, all hopes dashed. Then we start an idea sliding down as if we were Debussy almost, from a dissonant chord, a heartthrob. We try do it lower. We have no idea what key we're in. Then instead of copying it a third time like any other composer, suddenly, as if he just made it up on the spot, short long, a jerky, heart-stopping rhythm. And then the beautiful dissonance and the same rhythm lower. But though that sounds completely improvised, as if we're wandering from key to key, if you look at the left hand, you see that we started at home and gone down a simple scale, the most basic progression of tonal music from the Baroque forward. Listen. Lower. Lower. Sounds improvised, utterly carefully controlled by the master craftsmen of the 19th century.
So despite all that ambiguous sound, he has a real purpose in mind. He's taking you somewhere, and you keep thinking you're going to land, and he keeps saying, nope, not here. You're almost getting there. You're almost getting there. You're almost getting there, but he keeps stringing you along.
And even when you get to the end of that first phrase, we're still not there. We're desperately hoping he's going to go. But no.
No, he keeps coming up with these little inventions that sound improvised, but as you say, there's deep structure underlying this improvisatory sound. Now, Chopin was writing this in the early 1830s. He would have known all the great bel canto opera composers, Rossini and Bellini and Donizetti and their work. And part of what goes on in that world is improvisation. Singers are supposed to improvise around a cadence and not just play a simple melody or not just sing a simple melody, but improvise around that. Does Chopin do the same thing?
What he does is gives you the illusion of improvisation while giving the careful technical control of a master craftsman. It's all about the illusion of spontaneity. So when we come back to that opening tune, he decorates it like a singer, but at the piano like this. But now here's the measure that makes Chopin so great. We've had one set of decorations with 9 notes. He then decorates the next phrase as well. But suddenly there's this spellbinding 15-note decoration marked delicatissimo that no one would have ever anticipated. And you can just hear everyone in the salon going, just dying, because nothing prepared us for it. So much about Chopin is creating a world. You play a melody, you decorate it with 9 notes, but nothing prepares you for the 15-note spellbinding decoration.
And that's just like what a great soprano would have done with a Bellini aria.
Exactly. And then once you've had the 15-note, you don't keep doing 15 notes. Then you come back and copy exactly. But tiny decorations, not this. But instead, you start with a rest, and then faster. But then, like a great singer, you don't copy it lower. You don't do the same thing twice. Instead, out of nowhere. And then just when you're recovering from that beautiful 6-note decoration, we leap to the highest note of the piece so far. And all of a sudden, finally, after 20 measures, we actually get the cadence we've been waiting for 20 measures.
And it's all the more satisfying because we've had to delay our gratification.
Now, there's
so
a message. There's a message for the economy. It's all about delaying the gratification, because when you finally get there, you actually appreciate it.
So we've been drifting along on this cloud. How does Chopin wrap this all up?
We come to this amazing coda. We take that opening mazurka tune's rhythm and look at it distorted through a funhouse mirror like this. The same rhythm, but distorted. We've got A's underneath in the left hand. Everything's being resolved. A's everywhere. All those A's we've been missing. And then right here, in one measure, he resolves the whole piece. Now, what just actually happened? You remember the very first measure of the mazurka tune, but it never resolved. We never got to A minor. Now he actually resolves those notes. Finally we resolve. But now watch this. We repeat that ending, and suddenly he reduces the whole piece to those last two notes, just this, which goes down into the left hand like this, then just the two notes in the right hand. The whole piece is being reduced to just those two last notes, then backwards in the left hand, then backwards in the right hand. The whole piece has been reduced to a single note, the A we've been longing for, but then in an amazing moment, as if from a dream, the opening that we've completely forgotten returns. And then astonishingly refuses to end. It's as if we're a dancer in mid-flight and we never land. The piece is over, it's finished, but it's not complete. We have the illusion that the piece could simply keep repeating over and over and over again, as it has for 200 years.
And I wouldn't mind a bit if it did. Rob Capillo, our What Makes It Great commentator, thanks for helping us understand what made Chopin so great as a composer for piano.
My pleasure.